of design history oral interviews. And today we're talking with John J. Jack Telnak, who is Chief Design Executive, North American Operations at Ford Motor Company. And it's May 8th. At our last interview with Mr. Telnak, we had pretty much finished up the description of your career at Ford of Europe, but I wanted to ask you two questions about your relationship with Joe Oros, who was then, I believe, head of design of Ford of Europe, and the system of logistical control that he instituted while he was there, which eased the commuting process between Ford of England and Ford of Europe.
Right, well, Ford of Europe organizationally was set up just prior to Joe's arriving on the scene and taking over as the VP of design. And I started there with Joe. We were in the process of still working out a number of the logistical problems of having a design studio in Merkenich, which is a suburb of Cologne, Germany, and the studio in Dunton, England. By that point, we had already, Ford Motor Company had already commonized its products. We were building one product for both England and the continent. Prior to that, it was unique products for both sides. So we had some unique design issues that we had to contend with, having studios in both areas, and we would have still have design competitions between England and Germany to develop a car line. And probably, you know, when I arrived, we were just embarking on the Fiesta program. So we actually had input not only from our studios in Dunton, England, and Merkenich, Germany, but also from Turin, Italy, and the U.S. And part of our responsibility there was to coordinate all of this design input into our shows there, and then work out the design critiques based on the products that we were getting from all of these different areas, which was really a good way to do it. And we probably had more design input from more varied places for the smallest car the company had ever turned out than on any large car or any other project I'd ever been involved with. But it worked very well. We did seem to be able to work out the logistics. We were flying models back and forth between England and Germany and bringing them in from the U.S. for shows. And you know, when I look back in retrospect, it seems like it was a bit of a nightmare to coordinate all of that design input from so many different areas and still come up with the right kind of a product. But it did work. The car, the Fiesta that was actually settled on at that time was the design from the Dunton studio in England. And after we got design approval, and I'll never forget that day, because Henry, maybe, did I tell you this before?
I'm not sure.
Okay, well, it was probably the most, it was one of the most exciting days in my life as a designer, because when the committee came over, the design committee from the U.S., which included Mr. Henry Ford II, and they met at the Merkenich studio, and we had three design proposals on the turntables there that they were reviewing. And this was for the final approval of the design of the Fiesta car. Mm. And they selected the car that, at the time, I was working for Joe Oros in our Dunton studio, and they selected our design, our theme. And Bill Burke was running Ford of Europe at that time, and they had scheduled that afternoon, this was on a morning, when we had the meeting, and they had scheduled a luncheon that afternoon for all of the people of Ford of Europe, a management level that would be involved in this program, salespeople, marketing people, product planners, engineers, designers, and they must have assembled about, I'm guessing, 400 to 500 people for lunch that day at the Intercontinental Hotel in downtown Cologne. And people were so enthusiastic about the design that was selected that Bill Burke said, after the meeting was finished in the morning, take that model to the hotel in downtown Cologne for a lunch. And we didn't have much time, we only had about an hour and a half, to get that clay model into the hotel so he could unveil it in front of all of these people that would be involved in the program, because they were there that day to tell Ford of Europe management, say 400 or 500 people, that we are serious about the Fiesta program. This is it. Today is the day we are embarking. Mr. Ford and the design committee made the decision to go ahead with the program, which was really a massive program. You know, it included building plants in Spain, the whole shot. It was really the largest undertaking we'd ever had. It was, in those days, it was an $800 million program, which was a heck of a lot of money these days, but in those days it was astronomical.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very exciting day because I asked our modelers and designers if they could get that model to the hotel in downtown Cologne, and I think those guys would have carried it on their backs down there to get it, and they were so enthusiastic about it.
Mm-hmm.
And well, Mr. Ford and Mr. Iacocca and Mr. Burke spoke at the luncheon to kick it off. And then at the prescribed moment, they said, "Now, gentlemen, we want to show you the model that was just selected this morning in the design studio." And we unveiled the clay model in front of all those people at the hotel, and everyone stood up and broke into a round of applause. And it was one of the most exciting meetings that I've ever been to, and it was, in effect, a pep rally, I guess you could say. In the meantime...
What year was that?
That's a good question. It must have been... must have been right... I would guess... 73.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would have been 73, probably the fall of 73, but I wouldn't swear to that. Mm-hmm. Fog in the time.
And the Fiesta was destined to fill a gap that you had in the
The main reason for doing the car was it's a B-class car, and which was generally the smallest mass-produced car in Europe. And we had nothing in that segment at all, and the company felt that we would bring a lot more traffic into our dealerships if we had a car in the B-class segment. And we were the only manufacturer in Europe that didn't have a B-class car at the time. And by the way, it worked like a charm. It really did bring people into our dealerships. And since we were the only manufacturer that didn't have a B-class car, Bill Burke's theme on the car was last in, best dressed. He wanted absolutely the best product, no holes barred, no excuses. And we went through a considerable amount of market research on that car, in developing that car, the most intensive market research that I've ever been involved in my career with a company. Even though it was the smallest car, only available in one model, I think we did more research on that than any other car I can ever remember. And obviously it paid off because we got it right down to the last detail. And I think one other interesting point is Lou Veraldi was in charge of engineering on that car.
Mm-hmm.
And now Lou Veraldi is here in charge of engineering on the Taurus Sable product line, and he's putting the same kind of emphasis on detail that he did on the Fiesta, which I think is a real tribute to him, because he was just leaving absolutely no stone unturned. I mean, this car will be 100% spot on, and that's the way the Fiesta was.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have what we call woodshed meetings over there, where everybody would come in and roll up their sleeves, and he'd get the top guys from each area, you know, the vice president of engineering, design, sales, marketing, manufacturing, and we would just stand around that car on a weekly basis, prototype models, and just go through them with a fine-tooth comb, and everything had to be spot on. And the way the car came out, it was spot on. And we were a little bit concerned because we launched the car in Germany, and then I think about 4 to 6 months followed on with the opening of our new plant in Spain where we were building it, and everyone said, "My gosh, you will never get German quality in Spain." But we did, and the car was designed so that it was foolproof. You couldn't put it together the wrong way. I mean, everything, it was designed to go together properly, to have the right kind of quality. And we sent a German team of manufacturing people that launched the car in Germany down to Spain to launch the car there with the Spanish workforce, and there was absolutely no way anyone could ever tell the difference between one built in Germany and one built in Spain. The quality was absolutely spot on. I mean, there were no differences at all. Nobody, and I think that was great for Spain also, because it was the first time they really embarked on a large program like that and did it successfully. So
that plant was in
Valencia.
Valencia. Yeah. And also fitting, too, that the name had a sort of a Latin ring to it.
Well, it did, and but that was interesting because we really wanted the car to have a German image, and the marketing and salespeople were coming up with all kinds of Germanic names for the car.
Really?
And then finally...
Do you remember any of them?
Pardon me?
Do you remember any of them?
No, I don't at the time.
It was codenamed the Bobcat, wasn't
it? It was codenamed the Bobcat, and that name was actually sticking for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, but we... finally, then, the word came from the U.S. that the company U.S. management decided on Fiesta, and we all thought, my gosh, that doesn't sound very Germanic, and how will the Europeans really take to that? And I think we finally sat back and relaxed a little bit, because we said to ourselves, hey, this product is so good, it will make the name. And Fiesta is not, obviously not a bad name, but we wanted something more Germanic. But in actual fact, it came out that way. The product was so good. The name worked, and we had absolutely no problems with it at all. And by the way, we had we apparently talked to GM before we used that name, because they were using the name Fiesta on an Oldsmobile, and we had to get their okay to use that name. So
they finally agreed to release it, did they?
They did, yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So that was before we decided, you know, before we firmed up on it. They allowed us to use it, which was really an interesting thing. But it was really an exciting program, and I'll never forget that day when we were at the hotel unveiling the car. I had my whole modeling crew that worked on the car in Germany, putting the final touches on the car. They came from England to Germany to get it all in shape. And we were so excited that while we were having the management luncheon, kickoff luncheon, I had my whole modeling crew and the designers that were involved in the program in an adjoining room, and they had a champagne lunch that afternoon, just in celebration of it. I mean, they were so excited about it, and it was really good. It was really good.
It went very well, did it not? Sold like crazy.
Oh, yes. It done extremely well, and it did just exactly what we wanted it to do. It gave us a presence in Spain, because we couldn't sell cars there without a very heavy tariff on them.
Yeah.
But by building cars there and exporting them, we could import other cars, and it really opened up a lot of new markets for us. And it's doing very well today. It's had its first major facelift this year.
Just this year,
the major one. And it's really holding its own in the B-class market. And it's a good product, and I guess it really proves that if you get the product right, you can sell. You know, just think of the customer and get the product right.
How is the Granada going at this time?
At that time,
yeah, or had it just been introduced?
The Granada, it was kind of just easing along, and we did a major facelift on the Granada shortly after that. Yeah, mm-hmm. My timing may be a little bit off, but it was a facelift that really turned the Granada on.
Okay,
and it's still carrying on very well today, but we're just getting to the point where we're changing that
just
now,
about
bringing in a new car
with the Scorpio.
Scorpio, right?
Yeah, right. Well, here you are in the mid-70s, and I guess Joe Oros has gone home to come back to Dearborn, and you're elected Vice President of Design for Ford of Europe.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And do you remember you came back fairly soon after that? Do you remember anything beyond the Granada facelift and the Fiesta that sticks in your mind from that period on?
Yeah, we did a major facelift on the Taurus and Cortina, which were essentially the same car.
The Taunus.
Taunus, yeah. Taunus and Cortina, and gave them more of a Germanic look, if you will. I guess that's what it was at the time. Mm-hmm. But the cars were identical, except for names. And then those cars were replaced with Sierra.
With what?
The Sierra that we're selling in Europe now. And
so did you have some input into the Sierra?
No, I didn't. No. I had some input into the Escort that's on the road there today in the very, very early stages, just before I left Europe. I think that was actually the last project that I was involved on at all, but a number of other facelift programs.
Well, you were, in a sense, you enjoyed your stay in Ford of Europe.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Those were really, really exciting years. It's hard to put a... hard to circle a year and say this one was more exciting than the last, because I enjoyed being in Australia, thoroughly enjoyed that too. Mm-hmm. The European job was a lot larger, but it was exciting. We just had some really exciting projects that worked out very well too, and we went through some tough times over there. The industry was really down while we were there, and the whole industry was in bad shape, but we always managed to just keep a little bit in the black, which was tough to do in those days, but it worked.
You and Bill Burke seem to sort of have parallel careers. You both moved from Australia to Europe, and then from Europe to Dearborn.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I think he
came on as NAD then finally.
Right. He preceded me by a year or so, both in Europe and in the U.S. And but he was he put Australia. Well, he did a good job in both places, in Australia and in Europe, because it really went through some very difficult times over there. But he, as I said, kept us in the black. He did everything conceivable to man to do that, but he kept us in the black over there.
Well, you're back in 1976, and you have this marvelous title, Director of International Special Vehicles and Advanced Concept Design Office. What did that entail?
Well, the title sounded like it entailed all sorts of things, and I guess it did, but the primary project that I was involved in as soon as I got back was the Mustang, the 79 Mustang program. So that was, 76 we said?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 76, yeah.
That's
March,
right. So
76.
We were just starting into the Mustang program, and a lot of people felt that there was a lot of European influence in the Mustang, and they probably weren't too far off on it. I think there was, but I think I came back with a lot of different ideas
a fresh approach,
really. Really a fresh approach, a different approach. I like to think a good approach. Well, it must be good. The car is still number 7 in sales throughout the U.S.
Really?
And it's really the 79 with some minor facelifts on it, so it's really holding its own out there, which I think just goes to show you that you can, if a car is done right, it will have some longevity to it, and it's really holding in there.
This was probably the first evidence of a new European look in the Ford American domestic product.
It really was, and it seemed extremely European at the time to most people around here, sure, including Jean Bourdonnais, because we had other models going in the building that were in competition with that car, and some of them, well, the next preferred model was very, very American, was what we would refer to as a filling out the cube model, a very boxy sort of a model. And I just thank God we didn't go that way, because I don't think that one would have lived as long. We would have been into some fairly major sheet metal rip-ups on that car today if we hadn't selected the one we did.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, really, the car that we did had a lot of support from management, and I fortunately made it through market research and just squeaked ahead of this very traditional American Mustang that was being proposed at the time. And I mean squeaked ahead, Dave.
Is that close?
It was very close. And
in terms of general acceptance?
Yes, in terms of general acceptance, overall image.
Yeah.
But fortunately it worked, and we were able to pull it off, but it was amazing to hear how many people thought that car looked European. Today, I don't think anyone would look at a Mustang and say it's European. But that was, well, we introduced the car in 79, and this is 85, and today it's normal design. I like to think normal, good design. But it's, you don't hear anybody refer to the Mustang as European anymore.
Was that the egg crate grill?
Yes, it was. The egg crate grill.
Now, that was startling, I think.
Well, it was an all-soft urethane front end. I think it was one of the first, and it was the first, if I'm not mistaken, it was the first slant-back front end we did on a car here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
I did another slant-back front end on the European Escort, what did we call it? I want to say SVO. I'm not sure the exact name of the car we did back then. Everybody,
it was a beefed up Escort.
Yeah, and everybody was nervous and jerky about this slant back front end, because we'd always done vertical front ends on our cars. It was a mild slant back, but so we did it over in Europe. So I had some experience under my belt on that and with urethane front ends, and that's why we proposed it on the Mustang. And I can remember while we were developing the Mustang here, product planners were going through the car and trying to cost it, which is their job, and they tried aluminum bumpers on the car. We actually built them out of aluminum bumpers, and it really looked sick. We just lost everything. And finally, we won out because of the weight save with the urethane front end, and I guess the cost, the cost was a little bit over aluminum. But the total design, there was just no comparison between the aluminum bumper front end and this total shape that we got with the urethane front end. I think we really had some significant impact on automotive design with that car, because then a lot of people followed after that with these urethane integrated bumpers.
Uh-huh.
I mean, others have been doing urethane. We did urethane bumpers on the previous Mustang, but we didn't do the whole front end, the whole front of the cab with a soft egg crate grill, and have that totally integrated look that we had on that car. So I think it was a bit of a milestone, and it's still selling well. So I think.
And you're pushing design, at least at Ford, toward the wedge at this point, too, aren't you?
We are still.
I mean, with the Mustang, there was just the beginning of a slope.
Yes, that was. but we never really got a lot of wedge, but we started to get wedge in that car, and I can remember the designers working on that car, Dave, and reviewing sketches with them, and saying, hey, wait a minute, your sketches are great, your small sketches, but when you get into full-size drawings, you're losing all this life. Now let's analyze it. What are you giving away? And they were giving away a little bit of the wedge that they had.
Uh-huh.
For example, the roof just didn't start at the windshield and fall off like we've always done in this country.
Right.
In their sketches, the roof had a little bit of wedge to it. Now we weren't putting wedge in the belt lines, but we had some in the. And they'd get into full-size tapes, and they would go back to this normal way of doing business here, sloping the roof off. And they said, you just lost a lot of the spark and a lot of the enthusiasm of this car. Where is it? Where's the emotion going here? And look, you're losing that wedge. And they kind of looked at me when, saying, is he really serious? Does he really want us to get that sketch in? And I said, yeah, I do. I really do. And when I came back, people were, they seemed to be afraid to express themselves.
Yeah.
It was more of a top-down management style that was being used at the time. And I wanted the designers to tell me how they really felt about design.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted them to feel comfortable disagreeing with me. which they wouldn't do, and it took about 6 months to really get them to say, hey, Jack, we don't think that's good, or we don't think your idea is good, we think this is better. And once they started coming around that way, I had a few started, but a lot of them were very skeptical. Once they knew that I was receptive to this, that I really wanted to hear what they had to say, whether or not I agreed with them was another point, but I really wanted them to tell me what they thought was good or bad. Once they knew that, and really came around, I think the design started to improve, and they were coming up with these new ideas. They weren't afraid to express themselves. And I think that car, that Mustang, is a direct result of it. Because I said, you guys are putting this stuff in small sketches. You must think that way. Why aren't you really carrying through on it? Why aren't you doing it in full size? Why aren't we getting it in a clay model? What do we have to do? And they said, they kept asking, are you serious? This guy really serious? Does he really want that kind of a step? Does he really want to break out of the boxy mold? I said, yeah, I really do. I had to convince him I do. I want plan view in the front end. Don't just fill out this cube. And I think that was a significant breakthrough for us in this building, that these guys started to speak up a little more and tell us what they really wanted to do, because the talent was there, and we used it. And
so in a sense, you brought a breath of fresh air from Europe, then, pretty much.
Yeah, I think some of that, and I like to think I did, yeah. Dave. And because I was pretty damn serious about it. I said, hey, come on, let's try something different. Let's really do it. And it connected, it worked, and it really kicked GM off, and then they came out with a pretty hot Camaro and Firebird after a couple of years after that, so we kind of...
You moved them ahead a couple of years, I think.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, well, their cars were looking pretty sick, and they did a terrific job when they brought out the Camaro and Firebird. They really did a terrific job.
Odd that they had the lead in downsizing, yet they chose to remain with the boxy look.
On the GM stuff?
Yeah, the GM stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't consider the Camaros and Firebirds boxy.
Oh, no, but I mean they're bread and butter.
Yeah.
And I think you pushed them into moving their design concepts ahead a couple.
I think so, and we're getting a lot of that reaction now with Taurus and Sable since they've been out and showed. Maybe you don't want to get into that.
I'd like to eventually. Yeah. Yeah. So in any event, the Mustang is a sensation, really, in a sense, a mini sensation in the industry, and they're selling well. And now,
It had the staying power, and that was important. That was one of the objectives that we laid out for ourselves in the initial design stages. And we knew that we would be entering this trend curve. If you have a bell-shaped curve, we knew we would be entering the trend curve in this country on the upside. That car would have been very acceptable in Europe. So we knew there was some risk involved, but it was a calculated risk. We knew that it may have a bit of a warm-up period with some people, but it would have a lot. It would have longevity, and that's important because the Japanese competition in that segment were changing about every 2 or 3 years. Toyota had about 3 models to this one Mustang model, and yet the Mustang's still hanging in there and doing very well. And I think that was a real credit to these designers. So we predicted that the car would have more longevity if we took the step, and it was a well-worked-out design. You can't just be different for different sake. It has to be different but good. And so the formula worked on that car, and we think it's working today on Thunderbird, and we think it will work on Taurus and Sable. They're taking pretty bold steps, too.
Beautifully. One quick question on the egg crate grill front end. How did you come up with that? What were your precedents in that?
Mustang, we wanted to use some of the design elements that Mustang had over the years. We selected different design elements, like maybe a heavy C-pillar or fastback or a hatchback, but we wanted and one of the design elements that was in the Mustang from day one was an egg crate grill texture. It was the first one had a very flat, almost mesh sort of a, but it was an egg crate sort of an effect, and we knew to get the aerodynamic effect. And by the way, this was the first time we really started talking about aero on a car, and we wanted to suggest aero with a car, which it did. But anyway, that grill evolved, so it was more of an evolutionary approach to the front end, done in a totally new manner with new materials. That's what really inspired the egg crate grill tech, that we thought there was a good association to have with the Mustang, because there were very few other design elements on the car that looked like previous Mustangs, in all fairness. But we felt we could work with some of those design elements and still maintain a Mustang look to it.
At this point, downsizing is no longer a dirty word, and it's been pretty much accepted in the upper councils of Ford Motor Company. And you worked on the Escort before you left Europe. Had some input into it. How did the fact that it came about as a domestic adaptation? Do you remember some of the details and some of the discussions that went on in terms of the Escort?
Well, yeah, initially we tried to develop a world car, one Escort for both sides of the pond. And we did a considerable amount of market research, both in the U.S. and Europe, on the Escort. Can I back up and tell you one little story about Fiesta that I forgot when I talked to market research? Just to show how thoroughly we market researched the Escort, probably about 6 months before introduction, we had a final round of research in Hamburg, Germany. And we took these very, very highly detailed models, they were as close to the real production car that we get, to Hamburg. And the car we were facing off with was the Volkswagen, not Rabbit, it was the next size down, the B-class car, because the Rabbit's a C-class car. In this country, everybody thought the Rabbit and the Fiesta, when we sold the Fiesta, were the same size car. Mm-hmm. They really weren't. They were distinctly different sizes. It didn't matter, they both sold there. But Volkswagen had one smaller than the Rabbit. Can't think of the name of it right now.
Not the Golf.
Not the Golf. The Rabbit was the Golf.
Yeah, right.
The other one was the Polo. I think it was a Polo.
Polo. Yes, right. Which never got to this country.
Never got to the States, no. So we were facing off with the Polo and with the Fiat 127 and the Renault R5. But it was mainly between the Polo and Fiesta in Germany. We had the car side by side, and we did not badge the cars. We had no identification on the cars because we wanted to eliminate brand bias with the respondents. And the cars were coming out very closely, except on the front end. The Polo was beating us on the front end. This is during the first day of market research. And the cars were highly detailed. The interiors and the exteriors, the instrument panel, we had almost believable, closest thing we'd get to a real cluster in the interior with the chaplets on the speedometer and all, were highly detailed. Everything looked very real. We had to do this because this was the last round of research, and we wanted to be best in class on every detail. And so we turned the interior around. We were getting good ratings on the interior, good ratings on the exterior, side view, rear view. But we weren't getting good ratings on the grill. And we had this louvered grill in the car. And it was at the point where we were really willing, Bill Berg was willing, the manufacturing people were willing to tear up that front end at the last minute, 6 months prior to intro, and redo it if it took that to make that car a winner in the front end. We wanted to be a winner in every aspect of that car. One of my designers, Graham Simons, who was a big English designer who spoke German, was standing around the research, and a German gal respondent was filling out her form on the car, and she was walking around the front end of the car, and she didn't know Graham. The respondents didn't know who was with the company, and we didn't even tell what company it was. And she started talking to Graham Simons in German. Fortunately, he spoke German, so we understood her. And she said, "That front end, there's something wrong with that front end." And so he came back in German. He said, "Well, what is it?" She said, "The grill. It was a dark argent, a dark gray." She said, "In Germany, it must be black." He said, "Really? Why?" "Because grills are black. They are not dark gray." And so Graham ran over to me after. He says, "Just for the hell of it, you know, we got black Krylon spray paint right there." He says, "Why don't we, before the group comes in this evening, spray the grill black and see what happens, rather than trying to change the front. You know, Dave, we sprayed that grill black. I had to catch a plane back to London." Dave Reese was with me, because Dave Reese was our interior designer at the time. And Graham jumped, we all jumped on the plane, and we had spray cans in our hands and everything else, and we had to catch that flight back. We had a meeting the next day, I guess. And the marks went right up. And so the survey went on for 2 or 3 days, whatever it was, and the front end just came alive because we just simply went from, honest to God, a gray texture to a black texture. And by the time we got the results, we were best in class on every detail of that car, including the grill. And I came back, and I remember we were having lunch with Bill Burke, and Jack McDougal was head of manufacturing at the time over there. And I said, "Hey, we got it. We don't have to rip up the front end." Well, they about broke out into a round of applause, because they were honestly willing to change the sheet metal on that front end to get better marks. Mm. And it was simply a color that popped up in the research. And to me, that was a fluke, but that's where research really paid off. We would have gone into a major change on that front end at the 11th hour if it wasn't for a little detail like that.
But anyway, that's a great story.
So much for research. We were on Escort and Escort research around the country before.
Yes. How did that? Were you able to come up with the results that you thought were significant on the Escort?
We were getting good marks, but as the research worked out, the American car did slightly better in America, and the European car did slightly better in Europe.
Really?
And I don't think the results were really that substantial. I don't think that it was significant enough to say that it warranted two different cars.
Mm-hmm.
However, in all fairness, maybe the attitude wasn't in the company at the time to do one car. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And although the cars are exactly the same dimensions, and there's very little commonality between the two cars. There are only about three or four pieces, I understand, some underbody structure that's common between the cars. Everything else really is different. But I, deep down inside, still feel that they could have been the same car, same design, even though we were building in this country and building in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have caused some considerable rip-ups in our manufacturing processes, because they were doing one-piece body sides in Europe, and we were set up to do multi-piece body sides here. Design-wise, but I don't know, say this and be very straightforward about it as an American designer. I think the European design was a better design, and I think it would have been equally successful in this country. And one of the major differences between the two was the Europeans did have wedge shape to their car. They had some wedge shape. They had a climbing belt. And at that time, Jean Bordonnais, who was running the North American Design Center, really didn't believe in the wedge. I mean, it was simple as that. We had a difference of opinion. He was a boss, so he went out. Simple. And we had many long discussions on that, and I can remember Gene coming in the studio one day saying, if that belt climbs as much as a 1/16 of an inch to the rear of that car, the guy that put it on is fired. He's out, finished, finito. And
yet he had approved the Mustang design, didn't he?
Yeah, but the Mustang belt didn't have a wedge.
Oh, okay.
The belt didn't. We had a little wedge in the roof and all, which everybody's uncomfortable with, but that was our first step, and we wanted it. But he said, that belt will be level. And he had his own rationale for that. He felt that in production, the rear ends are built high and the car has automatic wedge anyway, which I didn't agree with. I still don't know if it's a longer wedge now.
Mm-hmm.
But I always liked the European Escort better because it did have that wedge. And today, while facelifting the Escort, I still find that a problem dealing with a straight belt because the whole industry has gone wedge now. And
can you move it?
No, it's a major rip-up now. You'd be up for new doors and quarter panels. I mean, that's really an all major inner panels. It's big bucks.
Yeah.
So, but
that wasn't quite the car they hoped it would.
No. And we had one here that was really a great car. It did have some wedge, and it was, I think, better looking than the European cars. We had the models here. We had the talent here to do it. It wasn't just here. It was just that we really did have some different design philosophies that we were dealing with at the time. And I can't complain about the American Escort. It sold extremely well. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
Feel we would have been a little more in tune, a little more update if we had the wedge, and it would have had more longevity to it if we did. And I just feel the European car is a better looking car overall. It really is.
I agree. It looks great.
It's, and every time I drive one around, you know, people want to know what it is, and you know, they can run out in the streets and look at it. It's that different. But that's the way the business goes, and it's still a very successful car. But all I'm saying is that it could have been one car.
Yeah.
I know it deep down inside it could have been. And even if we have different manufacturing processes here, it didn't matter. We could have made one design, but the culture
hadn't moved
in-house
that
far culture didn't, really didn't. It wasn't. And there were many other issues, I'm sure, that were walking around in the background on that car. And people convinced themselves that they had to be unique cars here and unique cars in Europe. In the meantime, Volkswagen's selling the same car all around the world. The Japanese are selling the same cars all around the world, but we couldn't. And that's.
It's frustrating.
It's frustrating, but we could live it. And we would have had the same amount of investment because we had to invest in tools and all, but we could have saved some on design and engineering if it had been one car, in all fairness.
Did you have any support for your viewpoint here in Durban?
Oh, a lot of people felt that way around here in a lot of different areas of the company, but the total corporation just wasn't on that wavelength.
Wasn't quite ready for it.
Wasn't ready for it, yeah. Mm-hmm. You don't move a corporation that way.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it wasn't a problem. The cars sold well. Their Escort sold well. Ours is selling very well, so. It worked. What we did worked very well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking from a pure design standpoint. European car versus American car. I think theirs is a better looking car. It holds together better than ours.
He would have narrowed the gap.
Sorry?
He would have narrowed the gap a bit if you had been allowed to go ahead and say.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Between the European and American.
Yeah. So. Oh, yeah. And it was interesting because Iacocca was here at the time, and I can remember Lee looking at the one car that we think would have done even better than the European car, and it very definitely had wedge to it. And he was asking me about the car. What do you think of this car? Well, that is it. That's the car I would really do. I mean, You know, I was honest about it. I was honest with Board May. I told Board May the same thing. That is, I would do the car with more wedge. But, you know, we just weren't thinking in those terms those days. So, I mean, it was, you know, it was an open discussion. It wasn't, anything bad about it, everybody. But,
go ahead. Without putting you on the spot, Mr. Telnak, do you think that it's fair to say that perhaps if it had come down to a decision that you and Mr. Iacocca would have been on one side and perhaps Mr. Bourdain and Mr. Ford would have been on the other in terms of that particular...
Yeah, but it never really got to that.
Never got to that.
No, fairness. Yeah. No. I think, because we then we have to play as a team.
True.
And, everyone had a chance to express themselves, and this is the way it came out.
The preponderance came out.
Yeah.
Against,
yeah. And, my God, you know, the car worked.
It
sold very well, yeah. Right. So I can't argue with success.
Well, you're into more exciting things in any event at this point, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're really, you've really made a decision to go ahead on a very radical course. Can you give us some of the details on that?
Well, I think after the, of course, after our first thrust was the 79 Mustang, and that was our first attempt at aero, and that's when we really started talking about aero in this country, and aero design, the aero look. And then Escort, I think, was...
sort of an interim kind of?
Yeah, kind of an interim car, but you know, obviously a very successful car, but it worked. Not an overly exciting car, but a damn good car. And I think then the next big design exercise, there are a lot of faceless and a lot of other cars that we got into in the meantime, especially our full-size cars, a full-size Ford and Mercury, mm-hmm. and Lincoln Town cars, very traditional cars. But then we made a big design breakthrough, I believe, on the 83 T-Bird and Cougar.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we really went all the way for aero and wedge and really got all the design elements that we felt were turn-on design elements. And it's interesting because those cars, well, they were being developed before the industry really got hit. Well, we got hit with the oil crisis, and we were in a downsizing process, and we got into that, and we're trying to take weight out of the car, and we achieved a lot of those objectives. But design-wise, I think we probably had a more significant impact on the industry with the T-Bird than any other car that we'd done out here in quite some time. And we had to set a real discipline in the studios to design the car in that we got much softer with the shapes. And the shapes even looked softer than the sheet metal shapes in clay. And it would have been very easy to normalize that clay model by rolling into the showroom, which is what we always do. And we call it refining. What we're really doing in many cases is normalizing and going back to where we are today with the design. But we really disciplined ourselves into living with the shapes on that Thunderbird. And it was a tough discipline to live with.
Mm.
And there were a lot of very uncomfortable people around this building. A lot of designers. I think we had a split house with our designers here. Some saying, you've gone too far. Usually you'll never hear a designer say that.
I was talking about commercial acceptance, certainly not design acceptance.
Pardon me?
They're talking about commercial acceptance. Mm.
Even design-wise, they just felt we'd crossed through that barrier and we'd gone too far with softness and aero on that car.
Mm.
And definitely it wasn't commercially acceptable with some of our designers, but they just thought we'd...
What about the product planners? How did you bring them around?
Well, they were pretty... We had a damn good team of product planners then, and Ken Coors was running planning, that mm-hmm. area of planning. And he was just a super guy to work with on the project. And... I think we worked extremely well with them because it was one of the first times that design and product planning worked that well together. But Ken, it was a matter of the right people at the right time in the right place. And
mm-hmm.
Ken was the right kind of a planner, and he had some good guys.
What's his last name?
Coors.
C?
K-O-H-R-S.
Right. Yeah.
He's running product development for Ford of Europe now.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
He's VP of product development.
Mm-hmm.
And we had weight and cost objectives that we met, and we actually beat our cost objectives on the car. I think we came in under $100, $100 under objective on the car, which is really good. And a lot of that had to do with these new bumper, urethane bumpers that we worked out for and all. And again, we felt that we were entering that trend curve on the upside, mm-hmm. design-wise,
yeah.
and that there would be some resistance to the car initially in the marketplace because the design was so revolutionary. But we felt it was worth it to go through that phase, and boy, here we go again, Dave, it's paying out. And the car caught on immediately in California,
big,
which I guess was pretty, and we predicted that. I mean, those people are receptive to new design. And it's got to be good, too, not just new and different. It has to be new and different and good. And we really follow through on our form follows function theory, and I added one other F to it, and that's flair. You've got to have excitement. You've got to have emotion in these cars. And some people thought the cars looked European. I don't think anybody says it's European today. You know, it's just accepted design today. Yeah. That's not bad to say it's European anyway. I'd rather say European than Japanese. And but the car connected in California is doing extremely well. You know, for the last few months, it's been the number one domestic seller in California. Well, that's not bad. And we believe that the sun rises in the west and moves eastward, trend-wise. So if it makes it in California, it'll make it across the nation. But anyway, it made it in California. It made it on the East Coast. The middle of the country was a little skeptical about it, I think, in the early stages.
They're coming around, though.
Dealers were a little, not a little, they were very nervous about the car. However, they accepted the Cougar nationwide. Cougar was accepted because of the formal roof and the Cougar. So we really felt we had our bases covered by doing both the Cougar and the Bird. We're going after different market segments. There was a recognizable difference between the cars, you know, a lot of differential between these cars, which is what we, that was part of our design objective. And so I felt pretty comfortable and safe in reaching this way on the Bird and moving in the direction we did on the Cougar. We had the bases covered.
Did you, was there a conscious trade-off on that formal roof of the Cougar? Did you say, well, we'll catch one segment of the market with this
very
low look?
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely.
And did that satisfy some of the split within your ranks here?
It did, yeah. It relaxed a lot of people right within our ranks here and with our management ranks.
With the management, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because they knew we had both bases.
Turned out to be a good decision, I think.
Oh, hey, well, I'll tell you, yeah, because, you know, the GM turned out with a lot of lookalike cars. Well, we really had a differential, and yet we've got an incredible amount of commonality between the two cars.
Yeah.
But they make two different statements, and that's what we wanted to do. So I think you know, it's a very cost-effective way to work out a program, and rather than just changing grills and taillights and bumpers, change the basic silhouette with the roof. I mean, it's a big deal. You put the money into a roof and a quarter panel, rather than putting it in all these other areas where we used to put it to get differential and never quite get it. We got differential.
Yeah.
Now we, from what we've seen at GM, they're starting to move in that direction too with this kind of differential.
What about that story that is accredited to Gene Peterson, that shortly after you got back from Europe, he gathered together you and your people and said, look, we want to really, we got to strike out a new direction.
Yeah, that was true. And I can remember him coming in, and that was right when we were into the Thunderbird program, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And Don Peterson did come in, and he said,
I'm sorry, Don
he asked, yeah, and he asked the question. He said, hey, are you, because we were doing some very traditional Thunderbirds.
Yeah.
He said, he just asked me point blank. This was before he was appointed president of North America.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that he would be the president, but I just kind of had that feeling because all of a sudden he was paying us visits over here, and he sort of feel, hey, something's happening. But I've always tried to be honest with our management and tell them what I did. By honest, I mean, just tell them what I think, whether they like it or not. I mean, that doesn't matter. I just, if they ask me a question, I'll tell them what I think. And he asked, he said, hey, what do you think of the cars you're doing? Are you excited about them? Are these the kind of cars you want to drive? And I looked him right square in the eye and said, no, sir, these are not the cars I want. Because, well, what kind of car, you know, what do you think the Thunderbird should look like? And I said, well, I'd like to have the opportunity to show you. And he said, well, maybe you will. Well, shortly after that, he was appointed president, and he made it clear, yes, I want to see what you and the designers think is a good car.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, we really struck up the band then and said, okay, we're going to show you. And that's when the car was developed.
Mm-hmm.
The car was actually developed, however, as a Mark.
Oh, really?
The first model was a Mark, and John Aiken worked on it. And it was done at a time, it was immediately after we, or right around the time we were introducing the previous Mark, the Mark 6, which was a very boxy Mark.
Mm-hmm.
And we were starting to break out of that mold, and I gave John design direction and said, well, try a Mark. This was in the early stages of Mark development. I said, try one that really breaks away from the traditional Mark that we have on the road today. What else can you do? Where would you go? What kind of a Mark would you really like to drive?
Mm-hmm.
And they did a Mark, and we went into market research with a T-Bird market research with some of the early models that we had. And I can remember the research was held here on a Saturday afternoon in our showroom. And the people were just, the response were not excited about any of the T-Birds that were shown. This is before we did the one that Peterson said. And I got Marty Goldfarb, who was the commentator or the narrator in the research. research and a guide.
Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm.
And I said, hey, Marty, nobody's turned on by these cars. And I got a markdown of a studio. It was a fiberglass model that we just did put on a shelf. It was very early on in the program. And I said, how would you like it if I took the mark emblems off that car and parked it in a three-quarter front view so they can't see the tire on the rear and just have these respondents look at that car and tell us what they think. Just what do they think of that kind of a car? Mm-hmm. I said, hey, great idea. Do it. So we did. We rolled this car in fiberglass model all covered up, placed it so they couldn't see the tire, at least while they were sitting in their chairs looking.
Right.
Now, once they got up and walked around the car, they saw the tire on the rear. But anyway, just from a three-quarter front view and a side view, Marty asked them, hey, what do you think of that car? And everybody, to the man, said, hey, now that's a new car. Yeah, that'll be a Thunderbird.
Right.
And then we said, okay, let's interpret that design as a Thunderbird, because the wheelbase was a little bit longer than the Bird, and a few other things were different. And that's when we got rolling on it and developed the Bird. So it was actually based on that first Mark proposal.
Mm-hmm.
But that turned them on. That turned on the respondents. That was really breaking with tradition, breaking with the mold, and getting a car that got these people excited.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we actually did the Bird version of that car and went into research with it, it started really connecting in research, and that's when we knew that we were onto something. Very
apparently, a great deal of credence is put into this type of feedback that you get. How does it work? You got a series of auditors picked at random, or
you
set up a show and tell kind of situation.
Yeah, we deal with an outside agency that bring in the respondents, and they screen them to make sure that we get the right buyer profile.
Sure.
And then we show them several models depending on what the program is. In this case, we probably had three or four models that we reviewed with the respondents to determine which ones were the best and most suited for the market, along with competitive cars that are also in the research.
Do you hold them out here in the front yard?
Sometimes we do here, but most of the time we hold them out of town, off-site, because we don't want them to know it's a Ford product. So we'll go all around the country, usually California or the South or the East, depending on what we're trying to find out. But the answers are very similar around the country. You get a little movement out in California, but they have slightly different looking cars. But we use that input, and I would say it figures into, somebody put a number on it once. I think they said at market research, accounts for about 22% of the decision. I don't know where they get 22% or how you can figure that fine line, but anyway. So we listen to research. We really do, because we are a customer-driven company, customer-oriented. We want to really know what they think. Now, it's difficult. It isn't easy. And I've been known to criticize our market research people, which I really don't want to do, because I can't offer a better way to do research. I think research is essential. I'm not sure we're using the right systems. It's a tough call, because I don't have a better system, and I hate to criticize a system if I don't have a better way of doing it or a suggestion to make on how they can improve it. And I don't know what else to tell them to do on it, really.
The mold is rather frozen.
Yeah, it is.
You might try something like the Institute for Social Research in Ann Arbor. They might come up with a different scheme.
Well, we have some other people that we have talked to in market research that have had good ideas, and they look at the market differently and all, but we're pretty well set with the research we have. So. But and we're working much more closely with our research people now. We're not fighting each other. We're really coming up with common problems and common solutions and agreeing, first off, agreeing on the problem and then going for solutions and working. It's more of a team effort now. So it's we're not there yet. We're still not, but I think we're a lot better than most people are at that end of the business. So we're learning.
Good.
It's getting good.
I need a good time.
The introduction of the 83 Thunderbird was, in my opinion, the major turning point design-wise in the history of the Ford Motor Company. We really changed and told the world graphically that we changed our design philosophy here, and that we really did subscribe and do subscribe to the form follows function theory of design, philosophy of design, and made that statement very clear with the introduction of the 83 Thunderbird. And I think a number of people initially were uncomfortable with the car, as we were in-house, as the designers were, as management was, but we all grew to like the car, live with the design. The design matured very nicely in-house prior to introduction, and we predicted that that same phenomena would happen in the marketplace, and it did.
And I think that was probably the most rewarding part of that entire design project, Dave, and that we did see it come to fruition. And we stayed with it. We knew we were on to a new design wave, a new design trend, and we had the conviction to go ahead and move ahead with that design and stay with it. And I think that was probably the most rewarding part of it. And I believe that now that the car has established itself in the marketplace and it has had a minor facelift, which we believe improved it, and our sales indicate very clearly that the car is just becoming, seems to be, it's just more successful with each change that we make on it. It's just convinced us that we're on the right track, and now people understand the car, that the customers understand the car, the marketplace understands the car, and this car will do more to pave the way for our upcoming designs than any other car we've ever had. So I think the car is paying off in many ways. It's a very profitable car for the Ford Motor Company too, which is always key in our establishing whether or not a product is successful. It can, I suppose, can be successful design-wise, but if we don't turn a profit with it and get the return on investment, I think the designer hasn't done his job, really. And we really did our job on this one. We think we've met both objectives. We're getting the right return on investment, and it's a successful design, and I think it will go down as a successful design exercise.
The, in a sense, the companion vehicle, the Mark 7, mm-hmm. were you happy with that design also?
Well, we went for a very functional image on the Mark also. And on the LSC has been very successful, especially on the West Coast. The people that have bought the car are, based on our research and interviews, are extremely pleased with the car. It really meets their objectives, and it has all the handling characteristics and dynamics that coincide with what we're suggesting with the looks of the car. So we're very happy with it. We think that the traditional Mark buyer probably doesn't understand the Mark 7. I have to distinguish between the Mark 7 and the Mark LSC.
Yes.
As well, because it is not a traditional car. This car will have probably a longer conditioning period than most new cars that we've introduced, and of course we've just taken a totally different tack with the Mark when compared to the Mark that it replaced. They are just at the opposite ends of the spectrum. That's all there is to it. But it'll be interesting to continue to track the Mark now with General Motors downsizing their Eldorado, which in that new downsized Eldorado will be out this fall. Now I understand it's 24 inches shorter than the Mark, so that's really small. So if people think the Mark is small, which our traditional Mark buyers seem to think, the Mark may all of a sudden this fall, when the new Eldo comes out, look very large. And it might recapture some of those customers that moved away from it a little bit, because in this downsizing world, I guess we got there first with the Mark in downsizing. We really came down in size, and it may not have appealed to some of those traditional buyers, but when the traditional buyers see that the whole world is coming down in size around it, the total environment has changed, they may find the Mark to be just the right size car for them. So I think the jury is still out, but I'm the eternal optimist, and we're going to track it. We'll just keep our eye on it. But the LSC has performed very well for us.
Could you explain the LSC a bit?
Yes. Well, the LSC, of course, is really a designer's car, or an enthusiast, a car enthusiast car. We've met all the criteria there that I think anyone with gasoline in their blood would really appreciate, and I think we've had a number of I've never seen buff magazine reviews as favorable as I have seen on our Mark 7. really. So the buff people really like the car. The enthusiasts are very impressed with the car. Unfortunately, there probably aren't enough enthusiasts and buff people out there to determine whether or not a car is successful. But I think, on the other hand, if a product is right, and I think the LSC is right because of its suspension and its handling characteristics and performance and looks and the ergonomics of the car, the interior of the car is well, obviously well laid out. Everything is very logical. And this is what the real enthusiasts appreciate in that kind of car. I think more and more people are trending this way, but a lot of customers that like that kind of design or like their friends to think they appreciate good design tend to favor European type cars, Mercedes and BMW to be specific, and will pay twice as much for a Mercedes or BMW. And in actual fact, find that the Mark delivers just about everything they can get in those other cars at half the price. You know, we're talking about a $25,000 car versus a $50,000 car. And some of them have come around. I ran into a fellow in California the other day that traded in a Mercedes on a Mark. He was planning to buy another Mercedes, but he thought he'd give a Mark an LSC a try. And he said he got the LSC and bought his son a T-Bird and his wife a Cougar with the money left over instead of buying just one Mercedes. I said, gee, that's pretty. And he said, I love the car. He said, unfortunately, he said, people think that I've dropped in status a little bit because I'm not driving the Mercedes. But I got to tell you, I love the LSC, and maybe if enough people see that and understand this car and really appreciate the dynamics of it, it will start to catch on even more. But I still think the jury is out. Some in the company don't think it is something that maybe we did just go downsize a little too quickly on the Mark. And some people think it looks a little too much like the Bird. So there are a lot of issues walking around on the car. And I suppose if we had it to do over, we may not have gone as functional, into the luxury functional image that we developed for the car. Or some people say it's just too damn European. That's all there is to it. And maybe we moved too quickly. But if we did move too quickly, I think the car still has an opportunity to mature, and that appreciation for it may come around when the new Eldo comes out and they find out how small those cars can really get.
You said in postmortems, were there any faint hearts along the way that might have counseled not to go too fast on this design?
No, I think we were on a bit of a roll, Dave, when the car was being developed, and we were very enthusiastic about the Thunderbird and the Cougar. And we really felt we were going in the right direction, and everybody in house felt, just about everybody that I can recall, felt that way. Upper management really supported us on the design. And but I think we could have done things with the car that, for example, in the interior on the Mark 7, not the LSC, but on the Mark 7 itself, we could have gone more American, and where we kept the interior very pure on that car. That's all there is to it. And I think for Americans still like shiny velour materials and the tufted seats and over padding and wood grain and chrome. I mean, they really do, especially that traditional Mark buyers, no question about it. And I mean, that's who we're trying to appeal to. And I think we probably just overcorrected a little bit and went and tried to sterilize the Mark buyer or purify him, and you can only take so much of time, and people really don't want to turn that quickly. We're finding out the traditional buyer, like I said, the LSC buyers love the car. Everyone that I've talked to just think the LSC version is terrific. It's just what we needed. I'd just like to see a few more of those buyers out there get a few more of modern Mercedes and BMW into this car. And I still think the opportunity's out there, so we'll see.
You're gonna hang on as a keeper.
Oh yeah.
I wonder if we could take the rest of the time we have available today to give us a sort of an in-depth look at the Taurus Sable project, which looks to be a very successful introduction coming up this fall, late summer, and the reasons why it was done, and some of the design problems and decisions you had to make along the way, and especially, apparently this was one of the first projects to have a really overall integrated team effort. Perhaps you could explain some of that
Yeah, I'd like to, Dave. First off, when we set out the objectives for this car and worked out the image strategy with sales, marketing, engineering, manufacturing, product planning, we consensed on developing a car that was best in class in every detail. And as far as we were concerned in design, we wanted, in the areas that we had control over, we wanted best in class aerodynamics and best in class ergonomics, best in class package. By that I mean the interior package, hip, shoulder, headroom, etc., and including luggage capacity. And that was the premise that we based this car on and held to throughout the entire program. And I've got to really give a lot of credit to our engineering vice president, Lou Veraldi, who was in charge of the entire program. And just give a lot of credit to Lou for, I think, the effort that he put into this and the guidance and the leadership that he provided on this program to ensure that we did maintain the original objectives throughout. And he did, because we are winding up with a best-in-class car. There's no question about it. And if you can judge a car at all by the reviews that we've been getting from the press, Buff magazines,